Brothers, I'd like to take this opportunity on your behalf to thank Father David for his thoughtful report and for his capable leadership of the National Advisory Council. I'd also like to thank Colonel Anita Raines, the chair-elect, and all of the members who serve on NAC, who give of their time and their talent in such a generous way, representing not only the church in our country, but particularly assisting us in our Episcopal ministry. Thank you.
Bishop Bambara, thank you. Father Whitestone, thank you for the service you provide to us as chair of the NAC. Also, thank you to Colonel Anita Raines, NAC chair-elect, who is with us as an official observer of this general meeting. It is especially fitting to recognize the work of the National Advisory Council during this particular year, brothers, when we commemorate its founding 50 years ago. Well over 800 members have served the NAC, including lay women and men, bishops, priests, and deacons from the 15 USCCB regions, and women and men religious from the Conference of Major Superiors of Women Religious, the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, and the Conference of Major Superiors of Men. The key to the success of the National Advisory Council is that it reflects input from the whole church. NAC has often been referred to as the church in miniature. The National Advisory Council was established in response to the Second Vatican Council's call for shared responsibility for the works of the church. Although the council pointed to the primary role of the laity, which is to carry the message of the gospel to the world in which they live and work, the council also recognized the contributions of all of the elements of the church in serving the body of Christ. The NAC embraces fully the message of the Council in that its members both bring the message of the gospel to their daily lives and also cooperate in the mission of the church. Over the years, the NAC has offered invaluable input to the Administrative Committee in its role of reviewing and approving the agenda for the bishops' biannual general meetings. I join my brother bishops, and especially those bishops who have served as members of the National Advisory Council, in commemorating its 50 years of service to the Administrative Committee and the Church in the United States for its counsel and support. Thank you, NAC. Thank you very much. Please join me now in welcoming to the podium Dr. Francesco Cesario, Chairman of the National Review Board, for a presentation of the annual progress report on the implementation of the Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People. Dr. Cesario, thanks. Welcome.
Thank you, Your Eminence. Good morning, Your Eminences, Your Excellencies, distinguished visitors and guests. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss with you the extremely important and especially relevant issue of sexual abuse of minors in the church, and to provide you with a status report on how the church is continuing to respond to this issue. Current events continue to highlight the toll of abuse within both the church and the secular world. Senate serves subpoenas for hearing on sexual abuse of Olympic athletes. Chicago Tribune report finds 500 cases of sexual abuse, rape in Chicago public schools in over 10 years. Catholic Church to pay $210 million to abuse victims. Chilean Catholics weather fallout from clergy sexual abuse crisis. Report on priest abuse in Pennsylvania to be most extensive yet. These recent headlines reveal the unfortunate truth that no part of our society, neither the church nor the secular world, remains untouched from the scourge of abuse. The extent of abuse in institutions of higher learning, Olympic sports, Hollywood, government bodies, and public schools, organizations where children and adult members should feel safe, is now more fully coming to light. Despite the progress we have made in the church and the ongoing efforts of dioceses, many among the faithful and in society at large question the commitment of the church, and in particular the bishops, in addressing the sexual abuse of children. The faithful demand that the safety of children and young people and the support of victim survivors remain core values of the church. This responsibility must compel you to never waver in your commitment to protect the most vulnerable, offer outreach and healing to victims and survivors of abuse, and defend the life and dignity of the human person. There is no room for complacency in this fight to protect our children, young people, and vulnerable adults. Since 2002, you and your dioceses have worked to better protect children and support victim survivors by committing substantial financial resources, staff, and effort to implement the guidelines of the Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People. The annual audit of the Charter remains an effective mechanism for your dioceses to hold themselves accountable to the faithful. According to last year's audit of the Charter by Stonebridge Business Partners, historic allegations of abuse continue to emerge. More troubling, current abuse of minors by members of the clergy, though declining, is still taking place. Last year's audit found that the number of allegations, the vast majority of which occurred more than 30 years ago, decreased significantly as compared to 2015 and 2016, and were similar to the number reported in 2014. However, there were 24 allegations that involved current minors. Of these, 6 were substantiated as of June 30th, 2017, and the clergy were removed from ministry. These allegations came from 3 different dioceses. 4 of the 6 allegations were against the same priest. 8 of the 24 allegations from minors were unsubstantiated. 3 of the 24 allegations from minors were characterized as unable to be proven, and investigations were still in process for 5 of the allegations. 2 others were either forwarded to a diocese overseas or a religious institute. Each allegation received by a diocese should serve as an important reminder that your vigilance is required. While the number of allegations has been decreasing, reports of boundary violations have been on the rise. These are red flags that cannot be ignored, as they could be a precursor of incidents of sexual abuse of minors. Based on the findings of the audit, 58 of 61 dioceses who received an on-site audit were found fully compliant with the Charter, and another 133 dioceses were found compliant with the data collection. 3 eparchies were found to be non-compliant with certain articles of the Charter. All 3 of these eparchies were found non-compliant with Article 2, which refers to review boards. 1 eparchy's review board had not met in several years. 1 did not have a functioning review board at the end of the audit period, and the 3rd did not meet the minimum requirement of 5 members, and it had not met in several years. The importance of the review board in serving as a confidential consultative body to the bishop cannot be overstated. Review boards help to ensure that allegations of abuse are taken seriously and that victim survivors are heard. They also provide the bishop with informed advice regarding an accused cleric's suitability for ministry. 1 of the 3 eparchies was also found non-compliant with Articles 12 and 13 of the Charter due to a lack of safe environment training and background checks. With that being said, these eparchies have communicated with Stonebridge and the Secretariat of Child and Youth Protection their plans towards full compliance with all articles of the Charter. Three diocesan eparchies did not participate in the audit. One of these dioceses was unable to participate due to Hurricanes Irma and Maria. The 2017 participation rate is similar to previous years. In 2015, six dioceses and eparchies did not participate. In 2016, two did not participate. Going forward, 100% audit participation must remain a goal of the episcopate. Efforts are being made to include these dioceses and eparchies in next year's audit. One encouraging result of this year's audit is the increase in the number of parish audits. During this audit cycle, among parishes receiving on-site audits from Stonebridge, external parish audits were conducted in 28 dioceses, as opposed to 23 the previous year. In addition, 95 dioceses now indicate that they perform internal parish audits, which represents an increase of 10 dioceses from last year. Unfortunately, some dioceses utilize neither external nor internal parish audits. Parish audits allow diocesan leaders to more fully monitor the state of charter implementation where it matters most. The National Review Board continues to stress the importance and the necessity for dioceses to perform external or internal parish audits. It is in parishes and in schools where abuse occurs, and where the rubber hits the road as to whether the charter and your local policies are actually being implemented. While the overwhelming majority of dioceses are meeting the requirements of the charter, and some are going above and beyond its guidelines, a growing number have become complacent in their efforts. This sense of complacency, identified by the auditors in successive years, has manifested in a variety of ways. For example, there are dioceses who do not complete background clearances in a timely manner. In some cases, the auditors found poor record keeping, which could potentially lead to unscreened individuals interacting with children. Diocesan oversight of parishes also needs improvement. In some dioceses, a high percentage of children did not receive safe environment training, the majority of whom attend parish religious education programs. Safe environment staff at the diocesan level have also faced difficulties obtaining important information, such as compliance data from parishes and schools. In some cases, dioceses do not require pastors to verify that they are implementing safe environment training in their parishes. Another form of complacency is the omission of the 2011 charter revisions by some dioceses in their diocesan policies. In some dioceses, recommendations made in the annual report or in management letters are not implemented. These are just some of the examples of complacency that have been identified in successive years by the auditors. Every bishop must ensure their systems of child protection and victim outreach are fully effective. If child and youth protection and support of victim survivors are core values of the church, every effort must be made to ensure adequate resources, financial, personnel, and time are dedicated to creating a culture of protection and healing. The recommendations of the auditors must be taken seriously by each bishop, and concrete steps must be taken to protect both the children you safeguard and your dioceses as a whole. You cannot afford to waver in your commitment to your promise to protect and pledge to heal. During the current plenary assembly, proposed revisions to the Charter will be considered for the first time in 7 years. The Charter revisions represent an opportunity to further improve your methods of preventing the abuse of minors. This year's revisions are the product of a dedicated effort by you, your diocesan staff, the National Review Board, and a variety of committees at the USCCB, including the Committees on the Protection of Children and Young People, Clergy, Consecrated Life and Vocations, and Canonical Affairs and Church Governance, as well as the Office of General Counsel. The National Review Board supports the proposed revisions to the Charter as far as they go. The Church in the United States has put in place rigorous safeguards for the protection of children. It is the sincere hope of the National Review Board that the forthcoming revisions of the Charter, the auditor's recommendations found within the annual report, and the following recommendations from the National Review Board will enable dioceses to more effectively protect and heal. The National Review Board continues to highlight the importance of sending all allegations of sexual abuse of a minor by a cleric to diocesan review boards, since we have learned in recent public cases that bishops have caused harm to victim survivors and their own dioceses when this is not the case. The need for review boards to meet annually at a minimum, as even when a diocese has not received an allegation for a number of years, the review board can serve an important role in reviewing and improving policies and procedures. A clearer definition of openness and transparency with the public and the faithful regarding allegations, including formal guidelines or policies for communicating with parishes and communities who are directly affected by abuse. Effective monitoring and supervision of offending clergy who have been removed from active ministry but have not been laicized due to old age, infirmity, mental illness, or other factors so as to prevent further harm to children and young people. Maintaining the independence and objectivity of the annual audit process in order to assure its legitimacy and credibility with the faithful. And finally, the use of formal policies regarding the review of boundary violations. As a result of the sex abuse scandals, the Church lost much of its moral credibility with the public. The bishops must continue to be champions for the protection of minors and the support of victim survivors so as to restore their credibility. The National Review Board recognizes the many burdens and responsibilities with which the bishops are tasked. We are committed with providing you with the expertise and advice that will support you in your ministries as the shepherds of our church. The National Review Board is grateful to the bishops for all they have done and continue to do in confronting sexual abuse. With the attention being given to this issue as a result of sexual abuse that has taken place in organizations outside of the church, you have an opportunity to truly model and lead society. This opportunity must not be wasted. As Pope St. John Paul II stated on numerous occasions, do not be afraid. Thank you for all you do to keep children safe and offer healing to victims and survivors. Thank you for this opportunity to address you, and I welcome any comments or questions if there is time. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Though Dr. Cesario will be with us throughout the meeting, do any of you have any questions right now or comments you would like to make? Please come forward. Do we have someone?
No.
No one at this time. Thanks, Doctor. Thank you very much, Doctor. At this time, brothers, we will hear preliminary presentations of amendable action items. Following the chairman's remarks, there will be an opportunity to ask questions of clarification only. Since we are not speaking in favor or against, please use a yellow card to be recognized. We will have the debate and vote on the items tomorrow. Amendments, by the way, are due at 5 p.m. today in the trays outside of this meeting room. Now let us proceed to the first action item, which is the Committee on the Protection of Children and Young People. Bishop Daugherty.
Thank you, Your Eminence. Praised be Jesus Christ.
Now and forever.
I need light. On behalf of the Committee for the Protection of Children and Young People, I'm pleased to present to you this action item to approve the revised Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People. The revisions to the Charter provide us with the opportunity to improve our methods of protection and healing based on our experiences since the Charter was last revised in 2011. I'm grateful to the many committees that have assisted in the revision process since it began in 2013. The extensive history of the revision process can be found in your green books. Please forgive me for not reading it back to you at this time. The proposed revisions to the Charter were reviewed by the members of the Committee on the Protection of Children and Young People, the Committee on Clergy Consecrated Life and Vocations, the Committee on Canonical Affairs and Church Governance, the National Review Board, and the Office of General Counsel. In addition, they received the support of the National Advisory Council. None of the proposed revisions to the text of the Charter necessitate changes to the essential norms. Modifications to the proposed revisions of the Charter were requested on the Bishop's Only site on March 28, with a deadline of May 21, 2018. All modifications submitted were reviewed by the Committee on the Protection of Children and Young People. You can find the chart of accepted modifications in your packets. If you have submitted a modification that was not accepted, you may submit your recommendation as an amendment until 5 p.m. today. Submitted amendments will be discussed by the Committee on the Protection of Children and Young People and will be either accepted or rejected by the committee. Tomorrow, the action item will again be presented, and charts listing the amendments, both accepted and rejected, will be provided to you for discussion. At that time, further revisions can be made to the document. Following the discussion, a vote on the entire document will take place. Now, I would like to highlight some of the main revisions to the Charter. These proposed revisions are in addition to a number of other editorial and stylistic changes. First, a call for dioceses to use what has been learned from the past, including the causes and context study, has been added to the preamble of the Charter. The recommendations provided in that study can be used to strengthen the protection of children and young people in our care through ongoing education, situational prevention, and additional oversight and accountability. In Article 10, a statement has been added for the National Review Board to continue to monitor the recommendations derived from the study. Within Article 2, the phrase, quote, other media, unquote, has been added as a means of promoting the procedures to make an allegation of abuse. This is to highlight the importance of utilizing digital media to promote the reporting of allegations. In Article 4, the clause, quote, with due regard for the seal of confession, unquote, has been added to Article 4 of the Charter regarding the reporting of an allegation to public authorities due to recent changes and challenges to the inviolability of the seal of confession. The statement makes clear the teaching of the Church on this matter. Regarding Article 6, which involves codes of conduct, changes were made to emphasize that all those who have contact with minors abide by the standards of behavior and appropriate boundaries. Formerly, these articles were limited to those people in positions of trust who had, quote, regular contact, unquote, with children and young people. The language in Article 12 was changed for the sake of consistency between the articles. A change to Article 13 also ensures that all those with contact with minors receive background checks rather than limiting it to those with, quote, ongoing unsupervised, unquote, contact with minors. Within Article 13, the changes have also been made to clarify the process for issuing letters of suitability for non-incardinated or visiting priests and deacons. In Article 17, diaconal formation has been added to the commitment of dioceses to strengthen initial and ongoing formation programs. The National Directory for the Formation of Permanent Deacons was also added as a reference. Throughout the Charter, we have ensured the appropriate canonical use of terms such as clergy, cleric, priest, and deacon. The next time to review the Charter will be in 7 years, which was changed from 2 years. This will allow for more time to determine possible revisions to the Charter in light of developing research and trends in the field of child protection and victim assistance. At this time, I welcome any questions or clarifications regarding any of the proposed revisions to the Charter, as well as the Charter modifications included in your packets. And as you can see behind me are the chairs of a number of other committees who might help to answer questions.
Are there any questions for Bishop Dougherty of clarification on what has been presented? At this time, we do not see anyone. Bishop Dougherty, thank you very much to your committee. We look forward to tomorrow and for the
thank you.
The vote.
Thank you.
I would do the
Action item two, brothers. This is being presented by the Committee on Cultural Diversity in the Church. Archbishop Gustavo Garcia Sr. was to present, but he's in San Antonio right now. So we have Bishop Oscar Solis, Chairman of the Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Island Affairs, to present on behalf of Archbishop Garcia Sr. The formal statement on Encountering Christ in Harmony, a pastoral response to our Asian and Pacific Island brothers and sisters. Bishop Solis.
Thank you, Your Eminence, and good morning, Brother Bishops. I am Bishop Oscar Solis, the Chairman of the Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Affairs, and on behalf of my brother bishops and members of the subcommittee, together with the office staff and consultants, I wish to thank the Assembly for the privilege of presenting the document, Encountering Christ in Harmony, a pastoral response to our Asian and Pacific Island brothers and sisters. We're extremely delighted for this occasion because it represents a significant recognition of the presence of the Asian and Pacific Island communities as integral part of the Catholic Church in the United States of America. Encountering Christ in Harmony, a pastoral response to our Asian and Pacific Island brothers and sisters. I would like to draw your attention to the gray book of our subcommittee. As our subcommittee seeks your kind approval of this document as a collegial statement of the body of bishops of the United States. The statement is a USCCB strategic initiative. In the current USCCB strategic plan, catalog of operation plans, one of the planning objectives of the Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Island Affairs is to coordinate a process leading to the approval of the body of bishops for a national pastoral plan for Asian and Pacific Island Catholics. This new activity of the Subcommittee on API commenced on the early or previous strategic planning cycle, which received unanimous support from the Committee on Cultural Diversity in the Church, and was consequently approved by the Committee on Priorities and Plans. The Subcommittee proceeded to implement the plan in three phases. Phase one is the preparation, consultation, and drafting of the pastoral plan. Phase two is the review and approval process. And phase three will be the publication and dissemination of the document once it is hopefully accepted and adopted by the General Body. The Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Affairs is happy to share with you exciting information about the Asian and Pacific communities in the United States. They are the fastest growing minority population. They are the third largest segment of U.S. Catholic populations. The exciting part is that the Asian and Pacific Island Catholics are ready for pastoral engagement in the Church's mission of evangelization. They have precious cultural gifts to share, strong faith, rich cultural values, and colorful traditions. The diversity in language, customs, and traditions enrich and at the same time challenge the U.S. Catholic Church in the pastoral care of Asian and Pacific Island communities. They need pastoral guidance and support for their full integration and communion in the Church, as well as further formation so they develop to become effective leaders and missionary disciples of Christ. In many cases, they are producing vocations in the Church at a larger ratio than their share of the Catholic population. The time is ripe for an organized national pastoral approach to ministry with the diverse and growing Asian and Pacific Island communities. I would like you to take note of the statistic or chart that highlights the major Asian and Pacific Island Catholic population in the United States, according to race, ethnicity, and birthplace group estimate taken in 2013. The title, Encountering Christ in Harmony, a Pastoral Response. The title in the early personal statement was that it is an Asian and Pacific presence, harmony in faith, issued in 2001. The bishop in the United States called for the development of a nationwide plan of action for the pastoral care of Asian and Pacific Island Catholics. This new document provides such continuity. Encountering Christ refers to the call of Pope Francis to the Church's mission of encounter and engagement with cultures, recognizing that in the encounter with Christ, culture is transformed by the power of the gospel. Harmony is a common theme in many Asian and Pacific Island communities that expresses the openness to encountering the Lord through their cultural understanding of unity in diversity. Why is it a pastoral response, not a plan? During the writing of or formulation of the document, the Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Island Affairs and the Committee on Cultural Diversity in the Church agreed to write a pastoral response instead of a pastoral plan. The rationale is that a pastoral plan identifies goals, objectives, actions, and metrics within a determined period of time. However, because of the broad cultural diversity among Asian Pacific Islanders, so spread out across the nation with specific needs and issues, it will be very difficult to put up one plan that fits all. A response is a better option. It offers a framework for dioceses and parishes to help them integrate these approaches and so they can have the free hand to create their own pastoral plan or actions specific to the circumstances and needs of their local Asian and Pacific Island communities. What is this statement all about? The statement provides insight into the Asian and Pacific Island Catholic communities in the United States today. The Asian and Pacific Island culture in light of the mission of evangelization and the current issues, concerns, and challenges of this particular group. In order to provide reliable data on the current status of Asian and Pacific Island communities, a year-long study of the Asian and Pacific Island Catholic communities was conducted by a team of social scientists, namely Dr. Tricia Bruce, Dr. Jerry Park, and Dr. Stephen Cherry. The result is a comprehensive report, Asian and Pacific Island Catholics in the United States. It was the first scientific study to focus on the faith experiences and aspirations of the Asian Pacific Island Catholic communities in the United States. Through analysis of available information on Asian Pacific Islanders from the Pew and Census data, online survey conducted in English and 12 other languages that generated about 3,000 responses, in-depth one-on-one interviews, field visits, and in-person observations, the report provided tremendous valuable information and testimonies needed to develop this document. And by the way, this report is available and can be accessed in the website under the Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Affairs. The focus of the document. The document offers four major cultural components of Asian and Pacific Island communities. These are identity, who they are as a cultural group, generation, about the multi-level generational groups, their leadership, and culture of encounter and dialogue. The structure of the statement, excuse me. Pardon me, I'm not becoming emotional. It's allergy. I don't want to be carried by my emotion. The structure. Each of the four components are examined through two lenses. The first lens is faith expressed. It views the stories of Asian and Pacific Island Catholics as part of our Catholic tradition, and at the same time emphasizes the uniqueness of particular communities. The second lens is under Faith Engage, that provides suggestions for pastoral approaches to specific Asian Pacific Island Catholics' needs and challenges. The purpose of the document helps advance the Church's mission of evangelization to the Asian and Pacific Island communities. It assists dioceses, parish leaders, and other Catholic entities, and the faithful as well, in welcoming and integrating Asian and Pacific Island Catholics. It likewise recommends new pastoral approaches in our mission of evangelization to cultural groups. And it also promotes collaboration among pastoral leaders in strengthening unity and diversity, integration, and communion. The pastoral response has tremendous value. It is the result of the unique collaboration between the Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Affairs, Asian and Pacific Catholic leaders, and many others. The information in this document is the product of laborious and expansive in-depth study of Asian and Pacific Island Catholics in the United States of America today. It is an intentional approach and missionary efforts to Asian and Pacific Island communities with new ardor and new methods. It also provides current information, renewed awareness, and continuing education and formation, not only for Asian and Pacific Island Catholics, but as well as for the leaders of the church. This document then gives a strong message. A collegial voice and effort of the U.S. Catholic bishops in their pastoral outreach to Asian and Pacific Island communities. My brothers, this document has significant meaning and importance. It will be the first official document issued by this body of U.S. bishops since 2001 regarding the growing Asian and Pacific Island communities. Our collective and collegial approval of this document will be indicative of an intentional pastoral outreach and an essential part of the mission of the Church in the United States. It is a response to Pope Francis's call to go to the peripheries to proclaim the gospel. To this pastoral response, our church is not only going out to the peripheries, but we are bringing the peripheries for closer integration and fuller communion with the church, the body of Christ. Therefore, on behalf of the members of the Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Affairs, office staff and consultants, and the Pacific Island communities in the United States of America, I appeal to your spirit of Christian hospitality to approve this pastoral response, and let it be our collegial voice, mind, hands, and heart to help everyone to reach out to our Asian and Pacific Island brothers and sisters as members of the church and our partners in the mission of evangelization. As I have indicated, the time is ripe for the Asian and Pacific Island brothers and sisters to come out of this shadow, from the peripheries, in order to become a part of the ecclesial mosaic of the Church of the United States in America. We want to thank all our brother bishops for the feedback and early requests for modifications to the various committee of the body of bishops, of the Conference of Bishops, for their input and assistance during the entire process. And thank you so much as well for your kind attention. At this time, Your Excellency, Archbishop, Your Eminence, we are ready to welcome if there is any possible clarification.
Thank you, Bishop Solis. Any of the brother bishops here who have some questions of clarification, you have a yellow card to hold up. Bishop Solis and company here are more than willing to answer those inquiries. If we see any. I can't tell.
Peter Baldacchino, Auxiliary, Miami.
Oh, very good.
Welcome to Miami. Welcome to Miami. I have overcome the
Pop, Bishop, please go to the microphone.
Wait, Ben. I'm coming.
This is my first time to make an intervention, if I may, please. And first of all, I think I have overcome the allergies of Miami, more or less, but I am moved by Bishop, if this is the moment to say this, I am moved by the need of evangelization. I myself spent 15 years in the missions in the Turks and Caicos Islands, and I appreciate very much the different cultures and the different needs of the people. Although I also need to emphasize, I feel that the announcement of the gospel is something that unites us and overcomes all the barriers. As Bishop said very well, The announcement of the gospel, the announcement of the kerygma, is what really breaks down the barriers among us. I'd like to bring to the attention of this body, if you allow me, Cardinal Di Nardo, if you don't mind, please. Allow me just a couple of minutes simply to make present among us here in this assembly a very important ecclesial event which I feel is part of my life, if you don't mind.
Bishop, this is really a time just for questions for clarification on the document.
Maybe I can have a moment later then, if you allow.
At another time you could do it.
Simply about the evangelization, the gospel, and how it reaches people of different cultures. You let me know.
I think we should do this maybe at the time tomorrow when we do a review of the document for vote. Rather than now when we're asking only for clarification questions.
Very well. Thank you very
much.
I submit your direction and we'll do it later. Thank you very much. Congratulations for the presentation, and I fully support what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Bishop.
Any other questions for clarification? There being none, thanks very much, Bishop Solis. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Your Eminence, and thank you, Brother Bishops. I express our sincerest gratitude on behalf of all the members of the Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Affairs. Thank you so much.
Brothers, we now have a 20-minute break. Come back at 5 to 11 for rejoining.